going to call to order the House Committee on Human Services. Today, April 3rd, 2009, I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 163A. I've lost my staff, so I'm going to read what it says.
This gives up you, ma'am.
That's all right. This gives nursing assistants implicated in an incident of abuse the right to a contested case hearing rather than an administrative hearing upon notification of findings by the Department of Human Services, establishes a nursing assistant registry in DHS, and permits DHS to place the abuse finding in the registry of a contested case hearing, is not requested by the nursing assistant within 30 days of the notice, prohibits employment by long-term care facilities or adult foster homes of individuals in the registry. Thank you, Carolyn.
You're welcome.
So, do we have anyone here to testify on this bill? Thank you.
The worst ones.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Gear. I'm the administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care in the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. Among other things, my office is responsible for receiving the federal money to administer the Certified Nurse Assistant Registry, and we contract with the Board of Nursing for that function. We are very pleased to have the opportunity to testify this morning. This is a bill that was requested by the governor on behalf of the department, and essentially what it does is it conforms state law to what the federal requirements are and what our current practice is regarding contested case hearings for certified nurse assistants who have been found substantiated for abuse or neglect in our long-term care system. The state law requires that CNAs have access to an informal panel to determine whether their certification should be flagged that they have been substantiated for abuse. The federal law requires that CNAs have access to a hearing. So on the advice of DOJ for the last several years, we've been offering both an informal panel and a contested case hearing. This legislation proposed removes the informal hearing, allows a CNA to go directly to a contested case hearing, and we believe brings us more in line with the federal requirement. So I'd be happy to answer any questions or go into more detail if that would be helpful to you.
Thank you, Mary. So any questions of this witness? I'm done. Thank you. Megan.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Megan Moyer. I'm here representing the members of the Service Employee International Union, Local 503, which we represent approximately 900 workers in nursing facilities, many of whom are CNAs. And I'm here in support of Senate Bill 163, which really puts the process for CNAs in line with all other long-term care workers in how their due process works through allegations of abuse and neglect. And we're really pleased with this because I think there has been some confusion within our workers around the process, and I think this really clarifies it, makes it more streamlined. I think is a more fair and straightforward process. So we appreciate the department bringing this forward.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions or any questions if anyone on this panel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody else?
Nobody else signed up? Debbie?
Do we have an amendment?
No, it's engrossed. So what we've got is exactly...
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 163, open up a work session. Colleagues, do you feel like you're ready to vote on this, or would you like me to hold it over?
Let's go.
All right, good.
Madam Chair, yes. I move Senate Bill 163A to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 163A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Van Orden.
Aye.
Representative Maurer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Yes.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Representative Dimbrough.
Aye.
Representative Allen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Excused.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having passed the majority, this bill, Senate Bill 163, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We need a carrier.
Oh. Anybody volunteer to carry this? I would normally give it to Representative Olson, but obviously isn't here. Representative?
I don't mind carrying it, Madam Chair. It was a unanimous. Is consent appropriate? Or
we could certainly put it on consent. We'll do it.
If that's not accepted, I don't mind carrying it.
I have no problem with that. Okay, this goes into the consent calendar. Close the work session on Senate Bill 163. Thank you. Okay, now we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 213.
This measure clarifies that out-of-state and internet sellers of tobacco products to Oregon consumers are subject to the same regulation as sellers located in Oregon. It ensures the applicability of the Attorney General's injunction to all persons, provides for a civil penalty for violation of tobacco regulations up to $5,000 per violation.
Great. Thank you. Is there anyone who is here to testify? Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Udland, and I am an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. This is a housekeeping bill related to ORS 18400 to 18455, which we refer to as complementary legislation. By way of general background, in 1999, Oregon, along with a number of other states, entered into the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement with a number of tobacco companies. Pursuant to that MSA, the Master Settlement Agreement, in order to receive an estimated $140 to $160 million per biennium, Oregon agreed to enact and enforce what we call escrow statutes. Those statutes are found at ORS 323-800 to 323-806. Subsequently, in the 2003 legislative session, Oregon enacted complementary legislation that's found at ORS 18400 to 18455. That legislation was enacted to help assist Oregon enforce the escrow statutes. Excuse me. Included in that, in complementary legislation, is the creation of a tobacco directory on which are listed the companies that can sell tobacco products in Oregon and those products that may be sold. Part of complementary, the primary purpose of this bill is simply housekeeping to clarify that the provisions of complementary legislation apply equally to internet sellers as well as those sellers located in the state. The bill does this by removing the language in this state. It's our position that the statute already covers internet sellers, and we've actually prevailed on that in trial court, and we're simply attempting to avoid continued litigation over the internet issue as more products are sold on the internet. In addition, the bill specifies that the remedies apply to all persons. The statutory scheme and complementary legislation continually refers to persons, but then the remedies refer only to distributors, so we want to make that consistent throughout the legislation. And finally, the bill will give Department of Justice a civil penalty remedy in addition to just the injunction, which will assist us when we're dealing with out-of-state internet sellers. The ability to impose a civil penalty will be very helpful. It's our recommendation that you pass this out of committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of this witness?
No, Madam Chair, just I don't consider this to be a housekeeping bill.
Okay.
Because we use that term sometimes loosely. I support the bill, but I wouldn't consider it housekeeping.
Okay. Thank you. Any further comments or questions? Thank you so much for coming to testify today. Is there anyone else here who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing no one respond, I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 213, and I open up a work session on Senate Bill 213.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, Representative Boone moves Senate Bill 213 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? You guys are way too easy today. Any discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Van Orman.
Aye.
Representative Mauer.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Dimbrough.
Aye.
Representative Callen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye, excused.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required numbers of votes for passage, this motion passes. And so, Representative, since you don't feel this is a housekeeping bill, would you like to carry this?
I knew that would happen.
Yeah, I knew it would happen.
No, I'll carry it.
Okay, great. Representative Mauer will be the carrier, and I close the work session on Senate Bill 213. Thank you, committee. So now we will move on. Let's see. Representative Kotek is still not here, right? So we're going to move on, I think, to 2905. Do I not have that? It's hiding. No, I don't have it.
Well, here, have my bill folder.
Okay. Thank you. So, Keeley. Oh, so did I say I opened up a public hearing on House Bill 2905?
House Bill 2905 establishes the Poverty Solutions Fund, and with monies appropriated to the Housing and Community Services Department for distribution to the Community Action Agency Network, serving the anti-poverty purposes of the network. It appropriates funds and declares an emergency. You did receive an amendment yesterday, which basically removes the appropriation amount.
Thank you, Keeley. So we have four people signed up to testify. Ryan Fisher and Jesselyn Ness and Jim Slusher will take first.
And Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm going to go down and
terrific. Okay. President Boone, nice to see you on that side of the dais.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Deborah Boone, House District 32. This bill is being co-chief sponsored by both Senator Johnson and myself at the request of our community action team in Clatsop County. Community action teams do the Lord's work. I'm sure you all work with yours in your communities. And they pick up a lot of, especially in the rural areas, they pick up a lot of the work for the poverty segment of our population in terms of helping people find work and housing, and they take care of the I'm not the right person because I don't work for them, but they do in a myriad of things. They do the weatherization programs, anything that helps people live better. It seems to come with the blessing of the community action team, and we rely on them in our rural areas especially because they do a lot of the things that the counties don't do or the counties pass on to them to do, monitoring block grants, etc. So this bill, although we had to take the fiscal out of it at this point, sets this up, which will be explained much more carefully by others behind me who will be coming up. But I wanted to make sure that we set this in motion, if at all possible, with your consideration today. This is a great program. This fits in very nicely with our kind of new paradigm of how we spend our money and get the biggest bang out of our buck. And most of these big bucks are federal dollars. So with that, I'll let those who are much more articulate and can tell you in excessive detail what this will do. Thank you very much.
Representative, I'm going to take a brief recess. Thank you. Come up. I'm going to take a brief recess. It's okay. Hearing on 2903. Okay, 2905.
And Ryan Fisher is going to come up and introduce his panel.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
While they're coming up, if this is the Lord's work, that would probably make Jim Slusher like an angel. And I got to think about that one.
It's a strange visual, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. We'll see after testimony,
all right.
Maybe.
Thank you,
Representative. He's questionable when he's on the golf course.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher, and I represent the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. We are the State Association of Community Action Agencies. I'm actually going to be doing my best Representative Huffman impersonation right now and do a little emceeing for the Community Action Agencies, which I know he's done in the past, and we're grateful for that. The Community Action Agencies serve local needs in local communities. And while each local community has different needs, and so all of the agencies are slightly different, they all do share one common thread, which is that they administer poverty solution programs funded by community service block grants. Community service block grants funds come from the federal government and are allocated by the state to the local communities. House Bill 2905 proposes that Oregon join 13 other states in a movement to supplement those funds with state dollars and create a poverty solutions fund. Today you'll hear testimony from Geraldine Ness from the Community Action Agency in Washington County, and she will provide more background on the community service block grants and how these funds can be used to provide solutions to poverty. You'll hear from Jim Slusher from Mid-Columbia Community Action Council, and he will present an example of how community service block grant funds have been used to leverage private, federal, and nonprofit matching funds to build a refrigeration facility. And you'll hear from Rocky Johnson from the Community Action Team in St. Helens, who will give a specific example of how community service block grant funds have provided relief to community members in Vernonia after a natural disaster. Before they begin, I would like to direct the committee's attention to an amendment that you've received. It replaces the originally requested funds with a blank spot. And what we respectfully ask the committee to do is after hearing the examples of how the work that the community action agencies are doing throughout the state, after you hear that, we hope that you will pass the amended 2905 to Ways and Means where it can be evaluated among other funding requests. We appreciate the great difficulties that you face in this economic environment, but we do feel passionately that the services Oregonians will receive from this investment are timely and effective. We believe that they provide key opportunities to leverage private funds and encourage community involvement. And we also believe that these can help families that are on the brink of poverty, helping them to avoid spinning deeper into the spiral of dependence on other more costly state programs. With that, I will defer to Geraldine Ness.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Tomei and committee members. My name is Geraldine Ness. I'm the Executive Director of the Community Action Agency in Washington County, and I have been working there for the past 36 years. I know some of you are very familiar with Community Action and have actually served on the boards, worked for Head Start. I guess I just want to open by saying how grateful I am that you are giving some time to listen to this bill in these very challenging times in our state. And this is the right time to be talking about this. It may not be the right time to fund it from a state perspective, but the fact that you're open to this is tremendous. These are extraordinary times. And thank you, Representative Boone, for your support.
Thank you.
I'd like to put it in a little bit of context, and I'm going to make an analogy to what happened with the Head Start funding. For years, we just had federal Head Start funding, and with that, we were able to do a really good job in serving families and children, but the percentage of eligible children we were serving was very, very small until the state came in. And when the state agreed to provide funding for Head Start that mirrored it, it allowed us to really grow that program and serve more of the need in our community. With the Community Services Block Grant, the community action world was created back in 1965 after the passage of the Economic Opportunity Act in 64. And every county across the nation was invited to apply for community services type funding from the federal government if they felt that they had a concern about poverty in their community that needed to be addressed. And so those counties that applied started a community action agency and to address the causes and conditions of poverty. And what we all have in common, there are 18 of us in Oregon, is that mission of addressing poverty in our local communities. And all of us have a board of directors that's made up of one-third low-income people, one-third public elected officials, and one-third private sector individuals. That's what we have in common and our shared passion to be there for our community's greatest needs. These dollars, once they opened the door to a community action agency, they came with a specific challenge to address causes and conditions of poverty, but to do it in a way where each community had local control and each community could decide on the highest and greatest needs. So there was a great deal of flexibility in that sense. Also a great deal of accountability. That's never been compromised in the flexibility that came with it. And so we have been growing our organizations to respond to our growing communities and our growing needs to serve more. And at this point, the Community Services Block Grant has also been used where, we started without all the communities in Oregon being covered with a community action agency. So over the years, we've been identifying areas that needed those services, and when we would start a new community action agency, we would divide up the total dollars between one more agency and divide again between one more agency. And we believe very strongly that the whole state needs access to these services. It was in the 80s when the community services dollars under President Reagan became block granted. So that's when it became the Community Services Block Grant. That comes to Oregon through Oregon Housing and Community Services. 90% of it is passed through to our Community Action Network, and 10% stays with the state, 5% for administration, and 5% for unique special emergency needs. It's called discretionary money. And there's an allocation formula that's used to send the money out to each of the community action agencies, and it is currently based on the percentage of poverty in our local communities plus food stamps, and then there's currently a formula that factors in farm workers. That formula is looked at by the Community Action Network and the state, and together we agree when changes need to be made to make it more relevant. The community action world in Oregon is made up of private nonprofit community action agencies like the one in Columbia County, like the one in Mid-Willamette. It's also made up of community action agencies that are called public CAPs, and they are part of county government. So Multnomah County is a public community action agency. So the county has that designation, and they get the dollars. They subcontract out to many nonprofit providers in the community. So it's a different service delivery model. Back when we were born, each county had the opportunity to make that decision. Most of Oregon's community action agencies are private nonprofit. Currently, I'll give you an example. In my agency, Community Services Block Grant now only represents 3-4% of my total budget. Those dollars are the most precious dollars we have ever had in the history of our work, because they allowed us to leverage and bring in all of those other funding partners that we now have. And as you well know, government grants and other grants come to us to do really important work, but they don't always allow us to cover all the costs. And Community Services Block Grant can be used to match and make those whole. For example, right now, there's just a huge crisis around people being evicted, needing rent assistance. In Washington County, I'm sure around the state. It's just unbelievable what's going on. So we have a lot of people in the private sector, faith-based community, local governments that want to raise money and give it to community action to serve people. 100% of those dollars raised will be rent payments. Somewhere we've got to be able to pay for the phone to take the calls and the staff that delivers it, and so we match it together with Community Services Block Grant funds. Also, for example, we'll get a grant that says we'll serve low-income people in this way. If we want to prioritize a certain group, such as veterans in our community or victims of domestic violence, we can use Community Services Block Grant to do a targeted service approach in that program. Right now, we have a big energy assistance program, as you well know. Washington County serves about 8,500 families a year. On March 3rd this year, we got nearly 2,500 calls for energy assistance. It's unbelievable what's going on. Community Services Block Grant would allow us to serve more people, but by putting it into that program, when people come in and need rent assistance and energy assistance, one person can help both because we can charge the rent assistance part to the Community Services Block Grant. So
give you another minute to wrap up.
Yes, I will wrap up right now. I think in closing, I think I'll just close that. I think I'll zip it up, and I'm just so grateful that you're even considering this. I can't tell you what kind of return this investment will make on the families in our communities that are really hard hit right now. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. The angel, huh?
Chairman Tomei, members of the committee, thank you. I don't know if the Lord approves of me doing this work or not, but we try hard. My name is Jim Slusher. I've served as the executive director at Mid-Columbia Community Action for the past 29 years. As you know, my agency provides a variety of services to low-income residents in Hood River, Wasco, and Sherman counties, and our mission is to eliminate and eradicate poverty in those counties. I'm here today to speak in support of 2905, the Poverty Solutions Fund, which will support current efforts to eradicate poverty in Oregon. The Poverty Solutions Fund would be used similar to those of the Community Services Block Grant, which Geraldine has talked about. For instance, in my area, some of the Community Service Block Grant funding was used to develop the Mid-Columbia Regional Food Facility. The facility serves 13 emergency feeding programs in our area, serving over 1,500 people per month. Without CSBG funds, this project would not have happened. Without Representative Huffman's help, it might not have happened also. But with the help of CSBG funds, we were able to secure a $300,000 community development block grant and then leveraged another $180,000 in local business donations, private donations, including Oregon Food Bank, the Ford Family Foundation, and the Collins Foundation. CSBG funding allowed us to develop this project. We now own the facility, which will serve our community for many years to come. The facility has freezer and refrigerator coolers, allowing us to receive all types of donations from the community, which we weren't able to do in the past. We had one store call us with 500 gallons of milk. In the past, we wouldn't have been able to accept that. Because of that, we were able to accept all of it and distribute it to members in our community. Many of the community action agencies around Oregon use their CSBG funds in similar ways that are designed to meet their local needs. In these tough economic times, many more people are coming to the local community action agencies for the first time, asking for help with basic needs like food, shelter, energy assistance, and medical help. Having a Poverty Solutions Fund would allow community action agencies to serve many more Oregonians living in poverty who are in need of our assistance, but we currently lack the funding needed to help. That's why I'm here today to ask the committee to support HB 2905, the Poverty Solutions Fund. It's good for Oregon. Thank you for allowing me.
Thank you for your testimony.
You bet.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rocky Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of Community Action Team. And I hope you're having a better week than I am, because a couple of days ago my dog got sprayed by a skunk, and so my house has been kind of smelly for the past few days. And if you move in that direction, it's okay, because I understand. I'm here to ask you to support House Bill 2905 for two basic main reasons. First of all, the problem of poverty has a negative effect on most areas of state concern, including public schooling, public safety, health care, as well as many other issues. And so to the extent that we can be effective at reducing the poverty rate in the state, it's going to have a beneficial impact on all the state concerns. Secondly, as Geraldine pointed out, for over 40 years, we have established a very effective statewide network of anti-poverty community action programs throughout the state. And these programs have developed a number of poverty solutions at the local level, which effectively move families and people out of poverty on a daily basis. And so to the extent that we can improve that network's capacity, we can respond to the economic difficulties that the state is facing currently today. And I have passed out a summary to give you an example of the work that we did in the aftermath of the Vernonia flood. So I hope you'll go through that because I think it's a good example of how the funding that we get can leverage many more resources and really do an effective job of moving folks out of poverty. As you can see from that summary, with a relatively small amount of poverty solutions funding, we were able to mobilize to date just under about $7 million, and we have been able to help 142 families restore their homes. We are currently working with another 100 families to restore their housing over the next year or so. In addition, we were able to restore the operation of the Vernonia Senior Center and the Vernonia Head Start Center in a relatively short period of time. We had both of those programs up and running within 6 months. And so in that case, that was important in terms of restoring poverty prevention services at the local level. For a relatively small amount of poverty solutions funding, we were able to avert poverty for approximately 242 families and restore those important poverty prevention services that are provided by the Senior Center and the Head Start Center. In addition, there's a couple of testimonies there in the material that I sent out that gives you firsthand sense of what our efforts mean to folks in the community. And on the last page, there's a picture of the Vernonia Head Start Center at the height of the flood, so you can kind of see the challenge that we faced in the aftermath of that disaster. So anyway, thank you for your time, and I urge your support of House Bill 2905. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions of anyone on this panel? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. First, I'd like to express my sympathy to you, Jim, on the loss of your father. And one of the questions I have is relative to people who qualify. Do you have to follow the same poverty standards that Head Start has to follow for people to access your services?
I would answer that, but I don't have a Head Start program.
With the Community Services Block Grant, we've been able to help people who are 150% of poverty, basically people who are experiencing poverty conditions. So we don't, Head Start is poverty level or below, up to. So we're able to serve a broader range. And in our communities, we are seeing people in those ranges that are becoming homeless, that are facing serious conditions of poverty.
So follow up, yes, thank you. So do you use income criteria for them to access, or is need the high, is how you determine?
It's need, and we use income. For example, if we're matching it with, like, sometimes we put money into our Head Start program, CSPG, we've helped them. We use Head Start criteria. We've used it with our energy assistance. We use energy assistance criteria. So it depends on if we're matching it with a program where there's criteria that comes. CSPG allows us that flexibility.
Thank you.
We're dealing with poverty.
Thanks.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I told you that these people would do a lot better job than I did as to the details.
You did a great job.
It's kind of hard to get your hands around what they do. This, and I called it Community Action Team, but Community Action Agencies.
But he's the team.
He's the team.
Yeah.
Rocky's almost a constituent, so it's I feel like I know him the best. But I kind of look at their programs as kind of the rest of the world's OPI, Oregon Project Independence, in a sense that it's preventive and it's preventing poverty and doing all it can to prevent poverty and just giving that little bit of helping hand to people, because maybe they only need a little bit of something, a little weatherization help, where they're very close on their rent or out of work for a couple of weeks and that kind of throws the whole thing off. But they truly do the Lord's work, and I know I see the little bumps in the backs where they folded their wings up today just to look professional. They are all three angels, and I'm sure there are many more around the state. So
thank you, Representative. Thank you so much for your testimony this
Thank
morning.
You.
Thanks for coming
Thank
to Salem. We have John Mullen, I think. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this legislation? Okay. Good to see you, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I had the pleasure of serving with the people that you have just heard from for many years. As I think many of you know, I was the director of Clackamas County Social Services for many years. And earlier this week, I had an opportunity to talk about my colleagues, Aging and Disability Services, and the pleasure I had working with those folks. My Community Action colleagues, we still are in touch and we talk regularly. And I just want to just point out that the family of services that were really developed during the 1960s include legal aid and community action agencies, Head Start, a variety of things. So we kind of think of ourselves as being part of the same family working on economic and social justice issues. But I would just say to all of you is that I've known these folks and my other colleagues for many, many years, and I'm just continually impressed with their creativity, their passion, and their commitment. And so I just would say to you that I'm just another person, a fan here today, talking about community action agencies and the good work that they do. And I also would just like to acknowledge the fact that you, Madam Chair, I first met you when you were in Milwaukee City Council and served on the Community Action Board in Clackamas County, and also Representative Van Orman. We have a long history working with Community Action Agency. Ask her sometime about the 25th anniversary of the War on Poverty. There's a good story there.
Happy to.
Okay.
Thank you very much, John.
Glad to tell.
Chair.
Okay. Yes. Oh, sorry.
Well, it's not a question. I just wanted to thank you. I wanted to make a comment about my recent visit to Umpqua Community Action Network. So we're not a team or an agency. We're a network in our area. And they have recently built a new facility down there. And I had had an opportunity to visit the facility as they were building it. And then to get to go back a few weeks ago when they're actually using it. It was amazing the amount of need they had and the amount of ability to provide that need that we're able to do in this building. So it was great to see the beginning of the project, and now it's in implementation, and it's a wonderful thing they do there for people.
That's great. Thank you, Representative. Okay, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2905. Thank you, Representative Boone, for bringing that to us.
And you are most welcome.
I will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2990. Keeley?
This bill establishes the Private Child Caring Agencies Fund. Excuse me. Allows the Department of Human Services to establish and collect fees for licensing private child care agencies, allocates collected fees and penalties to the established fund for enforcement of regulations pertaining to private child caring agencies.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kotek, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Morning, colleagues. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. House Bill 2990, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. It's Friday. We're all trying to keep track of what we're doing.
I know it.
I really appreciate the time this morning to talk about this bill. What you are receiving from staff is a copy of an article that was published in December of last year talking about two facilities, the Pendleton Academies and Kirkland Institute. And it's the reason that I decided to introduce this bill, to try to get a handle on a problem that the state is facing in terms of ensuring that children who are in child caring agencies across the state are safe, and that reports of abuse and neglect can be adequately responded to. You will be hearing from the department exactly what a child caring agency is. They will have a list, but it's not a child care provider. Child caring agencies, there's about 240 of them across the state. They're anywhere from boarding schools to 24-hour residential treatment centers. The state currently is not permitted in statute to ask or apply licensing fees to these facilities.
the challenge of that is, in this state, we have two individuals who are charged with responding to reports of abuse and neglect at these 200-plus agencies. And the irony of some of this is, I believe we'll learn from the agency, that in this current biennium, the agency within the Department of Human Services that does training and oversight was asked to, they received additional resources, investigators and trainers, to go out to these agencies and talk about abuse, neglect, and talk about safety issues. As a result, not just because of that, but I'm sure that was part of the reason, there were an increased number of reports of abuse and neglect at these agencies. But we didn't have a similar level of increased resources for the two individuals to respond to those complaints. And one of the things, one of the striking statistics is, for example, because of the increase in awareness and diligence from these agencies in reporting incidences of safety, these two staff individuals were responsible for following up on over 680 reports of abuse and neglect in the first 9 months of 2008. I'd like to say that again. Two individuals overseeing 200-plus agencies in the state were responsible for following up on over 680 reports of abuse and neglect in the first 9 months of 2008. What this bill is attempting to do is to start the conversation about permitting the department to levy a licensing fee on these agencies to be deposited in such a way to help with the oversight. And we're going to hear from individuals who are here to testify today who have all kinds of concerns about the resources that we are providing if they indeed get state funds for children in their care. As chair of the Subcommittee on Human Services, I know that we under-resource these agencies who serve our most at-risk kids. I think that's an important conversation. I believe this is a separate discussion, however, about oversight and accountability and the ability of the state to do their job. Because when things go wrong, we point fingers at the Department of Human Services, but we don't give them the resources to properly respond to complaints. And one of the other things is you see in this article, in some cases, problems were going on for quite a long time. And at the end, the department felt they needed to shut these places down. We have to think about maybe different ways of dealing with incidents, finding them, having other sanctions short of closing these places down, because that does also cause disruption in communities, to families, to the kids in the care. So we have a difficult problem here. This bill is about a potential solution, allowing the department to levy licensing fees to deal with accountability and oversight when the need arises. And so I just want to keep that in mind. That's the source of where this bill came from, and I believe the department could probably answer your specific questions on how things work, but I just wanted to set some context. So thank you very much.
Are you open to questions, Representative?
I am.
Great. Any questions? Yes, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. And I think I heard you answer this in your testimony. Are these different facilities, are they funded by the state in some part? Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, some of them do receive funding from the state. Some do not. Just like we license other facilities in the state within the Children, Adult, and Families Division, Department of Human Services, they are charged with these child caring agencies. Not all of them receive public funds, but there is an expectation that, particularly, I think, for the folks who send their kids to these places, that they are licensed and therefore there is some level of oversight whether or not they receive public funds or not. And you will see a list from the department, and you'll be able to see some receive a significant amount of funding, others do not. Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Okay, and this may be because I haven't had the second cup yet. But, so if these agencies are not, or these services are not licensed, do they still receive state funding?
Madam Chair,
ones that are not licensed. I mean, if they're not licensed, you said some of them receive state funding, and I'm wondering if they're not licensed.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, my assumption would be is if they wanted to provide programs that would receive state reimbursement, they would have to be licensed. But there are agencies on that list who are licensed because that is essentially how you become an operator in the state to do certain services, but they might not receive state funding to do
something. Okay, right. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Representative Kotek. So we have these people coming to testify: Aaron Kelly Seal, Chris
Crink, do I have that correct? Are you bringing up a panel?
If I could bring up my manager of the licensing
sure.
unit, that
sure. would be... Sure, absolutely.
Just for questions.
All right, great.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Erin Kelly-Seal, and I'm the Interim Assistant Director for the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And with me is my manager for our Residential Treatment and Licensing Unit within the Children, Adults, and Families Division, Donna Ketty. So I appreciate the time that you're taking this morning to focus again on the safety of children in our state. And before, when I've sat at the dais talking with you, I've focused really exclusively on children who are within state custody and foster care. Today I'm here to talk to you about our responsibility in the Children, Adults, and Families Division for the safety of all children, not just those, as you just discussed with Representative Kotek, that the state supports in 24-hour care facilities, but also private citizens of this state, of other states, who take advantage of programs that we have to offer in this state and the safety of their children as well. A private agency, private child caring agency, the name I struggle with, I must admit, since I've been trying to commit it to memory, but really what it's intending to describe are private agencies that care for children on a 24-hour-a-day basis, and that's with the exception of hospital-based care and facilities licensed by the seniors, for children, I should say, by Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. CAF, the Children, Adults, and Families Division, has responsibility for licensing and oversight of all private child caring agencies in the state. And as you heard Representative Kotek mention, there are today 237 agencies that we license and are responsible for monitoring and overseeing. And we did hand out to you two lists, one that just describes the name and in general the type of facility that we're talking about, and a second list that by county list includes not just the name of the facility but the type of facility that it is specifically being referred to, and also the county and city in which they are located. As I say, one of the things I think people don't understand about our particular responsibility in this case is that our licensing unit provides this monitoring and oversight for a variety of private agencies. About 66% or two-thirds of them are in no way affiliated with children we serve through the Department of Human Services. So over two-thirds of the children who are served in these facilities, over two-thirds of the facilities is probably the better way to say it, I'm sorry, receive no public money, are simply private agencies that are licensed by the state, and the state's responsibility in those organizations is to make sure that the environment is safe for children. Let me just give you some examples of the kinds of agencies we're talking about. We're talking about private adoption agencies, homeless, runaway, and transitional living centers, academic boarding schools, therapeutic boarding schools, day treatment programs, residential care facilities, private foster care agencies, and outdoor youth programs. The current requirements for our licensing unit, I just want to kind of walk you through what we do today and what House Bill 2990 would allow us to do. And again, we do support this bill, and we are very thankful to Representative Kotek for starting the conversation, as she said, about our capacity to adequately protect the safety of children in these facilities. Today, the licensing unit sets standards for health and safety for private child caring agencies. We have rules that reflect those standards. We conduct site reviews of each program a minimum of one time every 2 years. And typically, those reviews result in an average of 4 corrective actions. Licensing coordinators are charged to follow up on all of those corrective actions and provide additional technical assistance to the program. They also, when they're able to, conduct unscheduled visits and reviews as needed, particularly right now because of our capacity constraints in response to complaints received from agencies, the community, and others. And those complaints, just so, and Representative Kotek mentioned this, those complaints are actually investigated by the Office of Investigations and Training. That responsibility shifted away from child welfare and to that office in December of 2007. But the follow-through with respect to the implications of those allegations on licensing and safety and health for kids is our responsibility in the licensing unit. The greatest volume of complaints and highest priority, of course, for us with respect to intervention is in response to allegations of abuse. And again, those abuse allegations are referred to the Office of Investigations and Training, which is housed in the Director's Office within the Department of Human Services. We have two licensing coordinators today who are responsible for all of that work with all 237 licensing agencies. And to bring a little bit of historical perspective to this, when CAF assumed responsibility for licensing these kinds of agencies, we had one licensing coordinator for 25 programs. Then the next time we got new staff was in 2002. We were given a second coordinator, and at that point in time, the number of these agencies receiving licenses had grown to 180. And today, we have approximately 240 of them, and still we have two licensing coordinators that are responsible for the work I just described. We support Hospital 2990 because it would allow us to begin to grow the capacity of this particular unit in a way that we believe will vastly improve our ability to ensure the safety of children being cared for in these facilities. And I want to give you a couple of examples of what we think might be possible if we're able to have some additional capacity. Today, it often takes us about 3 months to process an initial application for a license. We believe that with some additional capacity, as a result of this bill, we can reduce that time to about 1.5 months. Today, we conduct one on-site visit every 2 years that is scheduled. With some additional capacity, we would hope to be able to do at least an annual on-site visit to agencies, and we would hope that one of those could be unannounced. We are very serious about our ability to timely follow up on reports of abuse and neglect that occur in these facilities, and what Hospital 2990 would enable us to do is reduce the length of time from the point of time of receiving a complaint to resolution from approximately 3 months to approximately 1.5 months. And that's, I think, a benefit not just to the children who are in these programs, but to the facilities themselves, who often are waiting for resolution from the state, and we have a delayed length of time in which we're able to bring that resolution and closure to them, to the community, to the children and families that are affected by the investigation itself, and we'd like to improve on that. And finally, I think also of benefit to the facilities, we hope, and Representative Kotek alluded to this, we take this responsibility very seriously, not just because we understand the implications for the health and safety of the children that are being cared for in these environments. And I think it is worth mentioning, when you heard me describe the kinds of environments we're talking about here, many, many very, very vulnerable children are being cared for in these circumstances. Some of them are there, as we mentioned, because they're in foster care and they've been abused and neglected. Others have very serious behavioral health issues, and their parents have asked these facilities to help them resolve those issues for them and for their family. So we're talking about some very vulnerable kids. But the other issue for us is that we understand these facilities provide jobs, and they provide a basis of community engagement with those children and their families that's really integral to communities. And we had a lot of experience and conversation with communities around the two facilities that Representative Kotek brought you, the articles that were written about both Kirkland and Pendleton Academies. The communities very much valued the role that those facilities had to play in their communities, both from the perspective of the therapeutic environment they afforded to children, from the perspective of the economic investment that was made through jobs and the benefit the program had for the community. And we very much understand that, and we take that very seriously. We would like, as Representative Kotek said, to be able, in lieu of having to simply move toward a more serious type of sanction for facilities, to be able to provide additional technical assistance to facilities, training, things that can help them come into compliance with licensing standards so that those facilities can remain a viable alternative for children in those communities in which they serve. And that's something that we think this bill would allow us to do better as well. I think you're probably going to hear from some of these facilities who may have a couple of observations, which I just might like to respond to in advance, and again, thank you for your time. First of all, we also very much understand that these are very difficult economic times and that everyone is struggling economically, and I have had a chance, both in my current capacity and my previous one in the governor's office, to study very closely the reimbursement levels for facilities and to understand the gap that exists between their operating costs and the reimbursement levels when it comes to state reimbursement. That said, I also believe that even in very difficult economic times, it's really important that we pay attention to what's happening in the lives of some of our most vulnerable kids. And I also think that this is a time when, unfortunately, our most vulnerable children and their families are most at risk. And I think it's really for that reason that we ask your strong consideration of giving this bill, which would give the agency authority to charge fees for facilities that we serve. The second point I think that you'll probably hear made is that we have some room to improve around the streamlining of regulation that occurs between the different kinds of licenses or certifications that some of these facilities are able to take advantage of or are required of them in order to serve the populations that they serve. And I want to say that I think that's a very legitimate challenge for us as a department to undertake, and we are committed to taking that on and being as efficient as we can be. As you know, we're in the midst of what is called the transformation effort, in which we're doing a lot of different work around the issue of streamlining and operational efficiency, and this is another area where I think we have some room for improvement. Again, that said, I think it's worth noting that about two-thirds of the facilities that we license and that this bill would impact are not licensed and do not serve children who are being licensed, who require licensure or certification from another part of our department. So two-thirds of these facilities we are solely responsible for in terms of licensing, regulation, and oversight. And so that conversation about streamlining doesn't really impact the great majority of these facilities or the children who are served on them, although it is still, I do understand, a very critical issue for that remaining one-third. And we believe the two conversations don't need to be treated as mutually exclusive. They can move forward together, and we can do better by all of the children that are being served in the entire continuum of care that our licensing unit is responsible for. I think it's also worth noting we did a survey of other states to see which of them happen to be in Oregon's situation in which we don't currently charge licensing fees for to these kinds of facilities. We only, as you know, responses to those kinds of surveys are voluntary, and we heard from, I think, 15 states and 16 states, and we are currently the only of those 16 that does not charge a fee for the monitoring and oversight that occurs in these kinds of facilities in other states. So I very much, again, appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you about this bill. I urge your support for it, and both Donna and myself are available to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Erin, for your testimony. I have a question. As I glanced through this, and maybe I heard it, and I just didn't click. But how many children are we talking about? I understand there are 240 agencies. How many children are in these agencies?
There are, some of these agencies have what we refer to as a licensed bed capacity, mm-hmm. and of those, there are about 166, and their bed capacity totals, of the 237, 166 of the programs have a bed capacity that totals over 3,600 beds. The remaining 71 programs have an unlimited bed capacity because of the nature of their work. Their foster care agencies, and some of those agencies may have close to 100 homes that they're responsible for. There are adoption agencies, some of which do up to 200 adoptions per year. And there are outdoor youth programs that serve approximately 144 kids per year in those programs. So we're literally talking about thousands and thousands of kids that are being served by these agencies every year.
Thank you, Erin. And of the 680 reports, I think that it was listed in COTEC referred to nine months in 2008. So how many of those were responded to?
We have some updated information, if I could, because at the time we were sharing with her, I think we only had the first 9 months of the year. We now have the full report for the last year in 2008. And again, this represents a shift in which the Office of Investigations and Training under the Director's Office was responsible for going out. They received, I believe it was five new staff. You want to help me out
yes,
here, Donna?
Yes, I think Chair Tomei, members of the committee.
Tell us your name first, please.
I'm Donna Keddie, Manager of Residential Treatment and Licensing with Children, Adults, and Families.
The Office of Investigations and Training began taking over the investigation in December of 2007. And with that, they received, I believe, five new staff dedicated to both training and investigation. And I also believe they received a management position or two to oversee that function.
And in 2008, 917 allegations of abuse were reported to the Office of Investigations and Training concerning 49 different license programs that we're referring to here. And those resulted in 51 founded abuse allegations in 2008. And in the last 3 months of 2009, 173 allegations of abuse have been received. And those abuse allegations actually are investigated by those investigators in the Office of Investigations and Training. But one of the dynamics that I think might be worth mentioning here is currently, because of our capacity, our ability to respond to those allegations, some of which may not actually qualify as abuse against a child, but may actually qualify as a violation of a licensing standard or condition, we aren't able in all cases to follow up on. We have to prioritize those allegations that do qualify and are substantiated as abusive because we only have two staff. And as Representative Kotek mentioned, there have been complaints both to us on the part of agencies as well as families and community members when we're actively involved in an investigation that it takes us too long to resolve the investigations that we end up being involved in. So, for example, we will issue a set of corrective actions to an organization that requires them to do certain things. And we are as persistent, I think, as we can be about follow-up and follow-through. We try and offer as much technical assistance to the provider and the agency as we can to come into compliance with those corrective actions, but because I'm thinking of a case last fall where the one licensing coordinator that I was aware of had actively three corrective action plans in three very different parts of the state going on at the same time. That person was required to be traveling to and following up on all three of those at the same time that she was responsible for doing her ongoing work with site visits and responding to more immediate allegations of abuse and investigating new concerns that came through the department. And so she was stretched incredibly thin, and it resulted in us taking longer than I think we would have hoped to resolve some of those corrective actions, which meant a lot of uncertainty for the children and parents in the program, a lot of uncertainty for the community about the future of that program, and a lot of uncertainty for the staff that were working there. So we, as I say, I think understand very intimately not just the responsibility to the child and to the facility, but also to the community and to the others that are implicated by the time it takes us to respond to these kinds of allegations and complaints.
Thank you, Erin. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Something that you just said, and I'm sort of trying to read several pieces of information here and listen all at the same time, so I can't, and I don't do that very well. But it sort of piqued my interest. You talked about of the reports, 51 founded or substantiated abuse allegations or whatever. Do you break that down at all in terms of, I guess the best way I would put it would be perpetrator. I'm reading the newspaper article or skimming it as we talk, and it looks like it crosses a couple of sorts of issues in terms of, in some cases, some concerns about backgrounds of staff or something of that nature. In other instances, instances that occurred might be abusive of one person in that institution to another. And I put those, I guess, in two very different classifications because, as you said, these institutions are dealing with probably the most troubled youth in our society. So there's a difference between, I think, three things, actually. Perhaps inappropriate staffing, an injury that might occur because of an interaction with a young person who is behaving inappropriately, and thirdly, some sort of an incident between two individuals in that institution. So do you break those kinds of things down at all?
let Donna answer the kind of data that we share with the Office of Investigations and Training.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Representative Cowan, you raise a good point. There are many facets. All of them fall to the licensing coordinators to follow up on in terms of health and safety. When there's a founded allegation of abuse, often it is the individual within the institution who has in some way been neglectful of their duty or not properly supervised and has done so against the policies of the agency. And then the agency can follow up on that and take action with that employee. There are other times when there are trends and patterns of possibly a lack of supervision, and it becomes more of a systemic issue where the agency's policies possibly aren't reflective of safe practices, which could, in fact, lead to a founded allegation of abuse. So we look at it from a number of different perspectives. The Office of Investigations and Training does have a breakdown of the founded abuse, how many fall into, the category of neglect. I don't have that data specifically with me today, but could get that if it was
you.
Wanted.
Just a brief follow-up, Chair. I think I'd bring it up because I'm not necessarily not in support of your proposal, and I do think that follow-up and supervision and insight is important. But some of the sorts of words that I'm hearing and that I'm reading in newspaper coverage, that sort of thing, when we say system or founded allegation of abuse, that sounds pretty bad, I guess is the best way I could say it. And I really will look forward in testimony from others who operate some of these facilities to that we all need to understand the very, very real challenges that the youth in these facilities face and the challenges of staffing that some of these facilities also face because of the fine line that they're operating on. I just flipped through and I looked at the three facilities that are on the list in my area that I know very well. And so I just want to make sure that we look at the whole picture.
Representative Freeman.
Chair Cowan. Cowan, I'm sorry. Chair Tomei.
That's another committee, sir.
I know, wrong committee. We did that one yesterday. Sorry. I'm trying to get my mind around what we're doing here. Are we looking to create a license and a fee for new facilities that aren't currently licensed? Are we talking about adding a fee to facilities that we currently license?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, we do an annual reissuance of the license, so for all intents and purposes, it's a secondary application. You don't have to reapply, but you do have to go through a reissuance process that requires a site visit and a thorough review of all parts of the agency. And so with that, we would want to initiate a fee at each two-year reissuance period, as well as initiate application fees for those agencies hoping to become a private child caring agency.
Just a quick follow-up. So are there private groups that do some sort of this stuff outside of your licensure, or we're not talking about including anybody new to this process, you're just wanting to change the process that people are already working under?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, anyone who wishes to become a private child caring agency would need to apply and pay the fee. And then those that are of the 237 that currently exist as private child caring agencies would be subject to ongoing fees every 2 years.
Just about there.
Thank you. Okay, sorry.
So what I'm trying to get to is the ones that are already licensing, I understand that, and that's the ones you showed us.
Right.
Are we talking about trying to license any other people that currently get to operate that don't have to be under a license or a fee?
Chair Tomei, Representative Freeman, this bill does not address casting a broader net for including new folks.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I feel like I've been thrown into the deep end with a lead weight, not knowing how to swim, and someone yelling, swim. Figure it out. Save yourself. the problem I'm having is I guess I'm lost in this conversation about who we're talking about. In my district, I have a place called SOASIC, Southern Oregon Adolescent Study and Treatment Center. I know those folks. I've been there. It's hard for me to believe that this organization isn't pretty well regulated. They have residential dealing with really difficult cases compared to Grandma's House of Central Oregon. I have no idea what that is. But I guess I need to go back to the very beginning and is SOASTIC not licensed? They're licensed, but someone's got to, I would assume somebody's looking at what they're doing. And I guess I don't understand where we are, why the system is developed, why 66% of them have oversight and the others don't. I guess I'm totally confused as to what we're trying to do here.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, let me see if I can give it a try and maybe Donna can help. But every facility on the paper in front of you is licensed
which
by
paper?
Us. Both.
What? No, which? Mean
oh, this? I'm sorry. Both. This one. They're both the same thing. These are both the same thing. This piece of paper is just designed to provide you an abbreviated version of every name of every facility that we currently license and that we have responsibility for, and that is regulated. This is an expanded
list. Why are we having Grandma's House and SOASTIC in the same conversation?
Do you want to talk a little bit about the grouping?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, this list represents the entire spectrum of agencies that we are statutorily required to license and oversee. And your point is well taken. They represent a broad spectrum of sizes, of functions, of vulnerability levels of children. Particular agency that you mentioned is an agency that has, you know, contracts with the state and has other people that have eyes on the program. The licensing function, you have to have a license as a private child caring agency before you can engage in any other kind of operation or contract to serve children. So that's the first step to doing business with kids. And then beyond that, you're a private entity. You can contract with whoever you choose. Many of the agencies are not like SOASTIC, and we are the only eyes on them. And when I say the only eyes, I mean we will do the site visit once every 2 years. And in reality, unless something happens, like a substantiated abuse comes our way from the Office of Investigations and Training, we may not have a reason to go there in the interim. And so we're in a position where these two licensing coordinators are driven in their job duties by the adverse events that occur.
Madam Chair, follow-up. So currently the law says the department shall charge no fee for its own inspection, leading to decisions regarding such licensing or for the issuance of such license. So you currently license organizations and charge no fee for the license.
That's right.
And in order to establish or to determine whether they meet certain criteria, you have to physically inspect that facility.
Yes, we do.
Follow up.
And why are you licensing? I'm going to stick with SOASTIC because that's what I know. And it's essentially a mental health provider for, really troubled kids. And there's other eyes on the target, so to speak. So why are you involved with SOASTIC? Well, isn't that redundant to have multiple agencies looking at SOASTIC? Don't they pay a fee through another system?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, we have a different set of rules that we operate under, and we look at a broad spectrum of safety, the facility, the personnel records, the incident reports, full documentation, staff qualifications. We kind of run the gamut. typically the types of services that are provided in these agencies, if they're under contract, you know, the contractor will have their own terms by the contract that they'll look at. But we're the initial piece and the consistent piece that crosses all of these agencies that isn't tied to any exchange of money. So if, for example, a facility has all of these different contracts and bodies looking at them, and those contracts end and those relationships, for whatever reason, end, we are kind of the last regulatory body before an agency. They could stay open by that license and still be assured, we could still be assured safety by that license.
One shortfall. So is this part of that transformation process and the efficiency is trying to align what other people within Department of Human Services are doing with what you're doing?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, it's my understanding that there's a bill that would require us to put together a work group that would be inclusive of providers to do that. It's also very much the case that on our list of a broad set of issues that I think is available to us to be streamlining, this could become part of that. That would be more a little bit more of an internal process through transformation, but it's not currently identified as a transformation initiative cross-divisional, but it could be.
Let's see. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mine's a lot easier. I just wanted to point out, this is 38 years ago, I was working in one of these places and as my internship for clinical psychology, and I find it kind of sad that we're still seeing this big a list. So, but thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Representative.
We absolutely need it.
Representative Denborough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, it really seems to me to be important that the citizens of the state feel confident that agencies such as this are providing safe environments for children. And so, you know, I think that oversight really is critical. And, you know, it seems that we would naturally rely on DHS to provide that level of that level of oversight for all such facilities. The one-third of agencies that are directly affiliated in some way with DHS or CAF, is there currently a higher level of oversight for them?
Chair Tomei, Representative Denborough, I think that by virtue of there being multiple sets of eyes on the program, that would be a true statement. That, you know, the more different sets of rules or contracts that you're under, the more people that are going to be looking at the functioning of the program, and in all likelihood, things would be caught earlier.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And do the different sets of eyes kind of share their vision? Do they communicate with each other, you know, to make sure that there's a kind of wraparound?
Chair Tomei, Representative Denborough, there is some of that, but I have to say, as Aaron said, I think that we can do better at that, and there are some initiatives that some conversations that we've started about looking at our different approaches and how we approach a facility when there are multiple regulatory or contractual oversight bodies approaching an agency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It would be great to see this this process be part of that larger process, and you know, as this is being developed and rolled out, and you know, I think also communicated with the agencies, you know, to sort of share with them and have everyone buy into this larger vision of more connection, as it were. And can I ask a follow-up on?
Yes.
It's not exactly a follow-up, but we're talking about the agency developing a set of a schedule of fees.
Okay.
I guess I'm sorry. We're talking about the agency developing a schedule of fees for the agencies. Can you say something about what kind of range of fees we're talking about and how it would be determined? Would it be determined by number of children in the facility, by the special needs of the facility? I wonder if if you could go into that a bit. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, the approach that we would likely take is for those agencies that Aaron described as having a bed capacity, we would tie the fee schedule to the actual bed capacity such that the smaller agencies would pay a smaller fee and the larger agencies it would have some it would increase with that. But we certainly haven't settled on anything like that, and we would want to engage people in that conversation. For the agencies that don't have a bed capacity, we've looked at the idea of the numbers of employees as a gauge. We did a national inquiry on many of these questions, and it does appear that most states that charge licensing fees do it by a bed capacity methodology.
Mm-hmm. Colleagues, I just want to point out I'm getting a little bit concerned about the time, and we have quite a few people who have come to testify, and some of these people from out of town. This is just our first public hearing. We'll have another public hearing at least, and we can bring staff from the agency coming to answer our questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more last, just to follow up. So, again, what kind of range of dollars might we be talking about? Have you...
Do you want to talk about what other states have done?
Yeah. I have about three states as a sample that I could give you today, and they do vary across the gamut. The state of Washington charges $144 per bed, and the state of California has a range based on bed capacity that is from $60 to about $3,502, and that one is, again, a range built within constellations of numbers of beds. There are others, I'm sure, that are less. Utah, has a flat rate of $300.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the privileges of joining you up here. I just wanted to point out, I know I had to step out, so this might have been covered. This is a preliminary discussion. You know, the department has not, as far as I'm aware, gone down this path of deciding what to do. Mm-hmm. The bill was in response to what seemed like a problem. There clearly could be criteria about how we set those fees. I think a work group would be in order if folks are interested in dealing with this in a timely fashion this session. But I just want to say that you're asking, I think, premature questions in the sense that we've identified a problem. You're hearing about the problem, and I think the solution needs to be worked out. But the department doesn't have some fee schedule set aside somewhere, I think, as far as I'm aware, ready to roll. We're not anywhere near that conversation yet. So,
thank you. So keeping that in mind, folks, that, as I said, this is just the first public hearing, whatever quick questions you have, and then I want to make sure that some of the other people have a chance to speak before we hear the next bill. So let's see. Representative Huffman. Did you have a question?
No,
okay,
me.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I guess it's just an observation that, and I'm glad Representative Kotek said that because, you know, as Shrek said, the onion has many layers. And this is definitely becoming a more complex circumstance than the bill would lead you to believe. And so I would like to see us do a work session on this to try to resolve this because it is essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Thank you. Representative Boone, real fast.
Real fast. I see it as...
Is there a question, Representative?
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, I'll poison the question then. Are you doing this in response to what we have... given agencies, you're asked to make cuts, et cetera, et cetera. We're saying we don't have enough money to do it now or unless you can find your funding.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, we have not proposed reducing any general fund that would impact this particular program because it already, we feel, is at minimal capacity.
Okay, thank you so much for coming to testify
thank
today.
You.
I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future. We have... I have Chris Crank, Janet Arends, I think, Rick O'Dell, and Sheila North. And if anybody from this group is not from Salem, if you would speak first.
I guess that would be me.
Madam Chair, may I make a comment while they're having a seat?
Please.
You're absolutely right. This is a very complex issue. I think we should just keep in mind, unless we are prepared to change the statutes around we set up a licensing structure because we feel there's some policy purpose for that, yet we haven't set up the resources to properly have oversight. We could change how we do, child caring agency licensing if that's the intent, but I'm just, it is the baseline. We require them to do that. So if we have questions about that, that could be an alternate conversation, but or one that we can include with this. But
right. Thank you, Representative. So I assume you're not from Salem, sir.
That's correct. I'm from Bend, Oregon.
Bend?
Bend, Oregon. My name is Rick O'Dell.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me,
Chair. I'm going to ask you, I know we've had a long discussion here, and if you could keep it sort of short, I'd appreciate it because we have another bill and other people from out of town. So
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
I'm the operations manager at J4J Youth Services in Bend, Oregon. Which
did you say your name?
Rick O'Dell. I'm sorry.
You did say it.
And I think Representative Von Orman is exactly right. This is about a shell game, just bribing Peter to pay Paul. As you know, and we can clearly delineate for you, private nonprofit programs are underfunded now. They have been for a very long time. We're somewhat fortunate at J4J because we, some years ago, instituted a fundraiser that we do yearly, which is a horse show, which helps subsidize all our other programs and helps with the vagaries of the budget that happens biennially. And so we literally have subsidized the state education department because we run schools full year. We've put out something like in the neighborhood of $200,000 over my 20 years there in subsidizing the Department of Ed and educating these most difficult kids. We subsidize Big Brother, Big Sister, runaway and homeless programs with these monies. We can't take too many more hits from the government. And this is about money, period. I mean, we are scrutinized. My agency is scrutinized by at least a dozen government entities now. So it's not as though we are not scrutinized and scrutinized carefully. So I'll just leave it at that. And you're all welcome to come to J4J and Bend anytime, particularly in July, which is the best time of the year. Not right now. But thank you for having me, and I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming out all the way from Bend.
Thank
you.
That was
probably an exciting trip.
Okay. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Chris Crank. I'm the president and CEO of Albertina Kerr Centers in Portland. We have services in Eugene, Salem, Albany, and the Portland metropolitan area. I find this an awkward discussion in some ways because I'm really a fan of licensing. I think that regulation is important for the safety of children, and we have been licensed as a private child caring agency for many, many years. So I'm not here to oppose licensing. I am, and primarily because some of the organizations like ours go over and above. We don't just have state licensing. We're also accredited by the Joint Commission on healthcare organizations. And so some of us, it's not that we don't believe in regulation and oversight. We do believe that that's very important. So I want to be clear that I'm not speaking against that, and I'm not speaking against the safety of kids. That's what we're all about. But I do feel that Erin Kelly Seal raised a couple of points, and obviously she's aware of some of our positions, and that's to her credit. But I really don't know that you can de-link things like efficiency, government efficiency, from this issue. I have my testimony. I don't know if he sent it around, but there's a list of, you can look at the number of contacts we have with the Department of Human Services over the last 18 months, and I can't count them on two hands. So I think that, and we may be a little different organization in the sense that we do have multiple contracts with the department, and therefore we have many different eyes from their organization on us, and as they should. But it, also, if you look at that list of things that visits we have from them, they ask for the same information over and over and over and over again from different perspective. So I do believe that there is efficiency, and I think that Aaron said that that's probably the case. So I would ask that that effort go forward before we look at assessing new fees. Additionally, I think Rick made the point well that that we do leverage a lot of other dollars. The system is terrifically underfunded. It has been for a long time. And unfortunately, I think part of the underfunding in smaller organizations leads to situations like you saw in the paper with Pendleton Academies and so forth, because they aren't large organizations. And so without economy of scale, we're about a $35 million organization. We have other resources. But I think the smaller the organization, the more difficult it is to comply with all the regulations. I might also add that there have been other regulations that the legislature has put on private agencies, which I really support but have not funded, things like evidence-based practices. There was a bill a couple of sessions ago, and I think that was a very good bill, but unfortunately no money came along with that. The over the last 2 years, the State Mental Health Division initiated a children's mental health change initiative. And I really support that, moving kids out of institutional placements into the community placements. We've done a lot of that. But, again, no funding came along with that transition, and there's been enormous training costs and so forth. So I would just ask the committee to look at, one, there may be differences in organizations among these 267, and you may not want to hit all of us with the same broad brush. And two, I would ask that you deal with the efficiency and funding issues before you levy more fees.
Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Madam Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Sheila North, and I'm the Executive Director of DePaul Treatment Centers in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here because we run an alcohol and drug treatment agency residential program for youth, and we provide mental health services as well as a school. I have corresponded with all of you with regard to this legislation, so I really don't know if I can improve upon what my colleagues have said, but I would like just to make a couple of points. I applaud the department's efforts to figure out how to create revenue streams for the work that they do. So that's one. I also believe in licensing and regulation, and like my colleagues, we choose to be licensed by an organization called CARF, which is a national accrediting organization, which holds us to very high standards. The other thing is that we were an organization started by the state to provide services for children with alcohol and drug problems. And unfortunately, we're underfunded. And because work with children is expensive, you talked about the issues that come up. It's staffing. Generally, you need eyes in the back of your head, and you need to make sure that children are never left alone. So the expensive staffing and the training of that staff are things that we must wrestle with at all times. So, and I wouldn't ever want it to be any different. I wouldn't want us to be unregulated. That would be a disaster. However, I would ask that you continue to apply the thoughtfulness that you are applying now to this proposed regulation and sort out the many different issues that are affected. And one of them is that we are licensed by three other agencies, and I think I said in my correspondence, multiple inspections and state inspections that take a minimum of 3 days. So I thank you very much, members of the committee, Madam Chair, for your efforts in this direction.
Thank you for coming to Salem to testify.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am Janet Ahrens, the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, and you've just heard from three of our member agencies on this panel this morning. And I just want to reiterate the theme here among our testimonies, that we are supportive of the department's work to make sure that the children that we serve on their behalf are safe and that our agencies are appropriately run and executing the services and the contracts in the best possible manner. I have some testimony which I'll hand over in just a moment. But the I just wanted to touch on a couple of points here. One is that we do believe that there are efficiencies that can be achieved by the department with a little more work. One of the advantages of the significant investment they made last session in a $3.2 million study, having the McKinsey Group come in and take a look at, in fact, at efficiencies in the department, was if you take a look at the transformation roadmap, you'll see that one of the comments that they make in there is that DHS has a total FTE capacity range savings range of approximately 600 to 1,100 FTE. Now, they are not suggesting that they reduce the 9,800 employees in DHS by that amount, but rather what they're speaking to is the ability of the department to achieve more efficiencies by redeploying the work of those hundreds of individuals. And we believe that that is a great recommendation and an opportunity for us to have further discussion about potential efficiencies that could be achieved within the department. We're also concerned, as all three of my members have mentioned, about the level of reimbursement that we receive on the contracts and the fact that additional fees are going to simply reduce the money we have available for the services and programs that that we offer. The department participated with the Alliance and a third interested or stakeholder party in conducting a $55,000 cost study for the Children's Mental Health System just a few months ago. And what we found there is that that system is underfunded by 40%. We also know, because employment salaries are such a significant portion of what our costs are, that that is not an uncommon underfunding number for the other service sectors that we represent inside the department. So to be significantly underfunded funded, and in combination with the opportunity that DHS has for some redeployment of staff and some look at efficiencies and oversight, we think is a reasonable place to look for some alternatives to the requests that they now have forward in the bill. The just one more example, Morrison Center, I know, has been in contact with some of you about this this bill, and they are responded this last year to 46 different entities and events for oversight, auditing, program reviews, and other regulatory entities. And I just want to make clear, they've mentioned some of the regulating entities that they respond to. They voluntarily seek national accreditation in organizations. There is oversight by CMS. There is oversight by the state of Oregon. There is oversight by other states that may have children contracted in or serving in or receiving services in these entities. They
I'm going to stop you for a second. I think Representative Huffman has
just
a quick question.
Quickly, a couple of things. In blanket, if you can, do some of your funding come from Medicaid?
Yes.
And over the last, say, 5 years, has the Medicaid funding stream changed in your regards? Did it used to be more direct, but now it's layered through one or two other entities before it reaches you?
Chair Tomei and Representative Huffman, yes.
Janet, I'm going to ask you to wrap up, if you would, please.
Certainly. Well, I think we've made the key points that we'd like to make. We would love to have an opportunity to respond to some of the other suggestions made by the department in their testimony and made by Representative Kotek. And we appreciate very much your interest in having a second public hearing on this matter.
Great. Thank you all for coming to testify today, especially the long drive from Bend.
Madam Chair, may I make a brief comment? I feel I need to respond. And again, I am very sympathetic to the resource issues. I just want to bring us back to some of the baseline issues here. I would be happy to champion looking at efficiencies around the different types of oversight that goes on within the department for agencies who have multiple reasons to be reviewed and audited. I think that's a very valid concern. The bottom line is, in statute, we require the state to license anyone who's providing 24/7 care for these kids. They are able to operate in the state as a child caring agency because of this license. We ask other group homes or other type arrangements, such as developmentally disabled group homes, to be licensed and pay a fee so we can provide oversight. I think we have to, is this particular subset of agencies somehow more special than others? I just want to put some context in here. I'm not saying there aren't resource issues, and I think we have to address those. But we also have 60% of the folks who are who have no contact, who have no other agency oversight, and we have to come up with a way to deal with the fact that when a problem happens, the public expects the department, by statute, to respond and do something. And unless we provide some mechanisms, and maybe this isn't the way to do it, but if we do not provide the resources, then I think we are derelict in our duty to uphold the statute that we have. So unless we want to change the statute, we have to think about how we handle resources on the oversight function for these agencies.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you for bringing this bill before us. And we will have another public hearing, folks, and see where we go with this. Representative Mallory, something real quick. We do have another bill we're going to be looking at.
Madam Chair, it was actually for Mr. Crank. It's regarding the JCO. I'm assuming JCO is a private not-for-profit, and I would assume that you do it because it's superfluous and it's free. I know it is obviously free because it's a private organization. So if you wanted to respond to that, I would be happy to hear your response.
And if you could give us a written response, that would be great. Could you do that?
Your question.
Sir, I've got another bill coming up, so I'm going to ask you to respond in writing, if you would, please.
Sir, it's not.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2990 and open up the first public hearing on 3114. Colleagues, we have less than 20 minutes, and can people stay a few minutes longer? I mean, people have come to testify. We can always get the agency here again, but if people could stay a little bit longer so we make sure that we hear from people who have come from out of Salem to speak. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Representative Tina Kotek, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. We're here today to now talk about House Bill 3114, and I will be brief. And I want to provide general context. Those of us who sat on this committee in the interim were very aware of this discussion that started back in the fall of 2007 about the level of medication that children in foster care in the state of Oregon are receiving, and what is the proper level of oversight. What this bill tries to do is start putting into place in statutes and mechanisms to improve the overall quality of mental health care for foster children, including better oversight of medications and more timely access to mental health assessments. In some ways, I'm trying to integrate two issues here. According to federal statute as well as state policy, children who enter foster care are supposed to have a mental health assessment within 60 days of entering foster care. Our numbers on this regard are very low, and the federal government has pointed out that fact to us, that a quarter to a third of our children in foster care get their mental health assessments within 60 days. It's very low. If you combine that with the issue that our children in foster care might be being prescribed one, two, or three psychotropic medications, even for children under the age of six, with lack of that oversight around mental health assessment, there's a problem here. And you just received the article that was on the front page of today's Oregonian. I commend the department for what they're trying to do. They recognize it's an issue. This bill is about trying to put into place saying what our intent is around when a child is assessed, when do we do review of their medications. And you're going to hear from folks today who have some concerns about how it's worded. I'm very open to that. It's an important issue. We have to keep the conversation going. And with that, I'll leave it up to the other folks. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any quick questions before we let her go? All right. Thank you. Erin, sorry, Debbie.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kotek, if the department's already making great inroads in this area, do we really need this bill right now?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I always think it's important to, for the things that are as important as this, to put in statute. And if we are going to make sure policy is directed to where we want to go as the legislative body, I do think these kind of things are important to have in statute. You will hear from the department about the progress they are making, and unfortunately, the policy option package around budget that they wanted to put forward to deal with some of these issues was not accepted in the governor's budget. I don't know how we, because people change in the department, and the only way you have continuity over policy is, I think, to put it in statute.
That's a good question. Thank you, Representative. Okay, we're going to hear from Erin Kelly-Seal. Is there anyone else from the agency? Looks like yes. Great.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Erin Kelly Seal, Interim Director of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. As you know, our division is responsible for the administration of the program of our child welfare program, and we are the custodian on a daily basis of approximately 8,775 children who are in foster care on any given day in this state. I want to just sort of make a couple of high-level observations, and I'll try to be brief because I know there are people who have traveled to be here. We are here today in support of House Bill 3114. We do have a few comments that we'd like to maybe have taken into consideration as the bill moves forward through the process, but we really want to commend Representative Kotek for continuing to champion this issue and bring it forward to you all, and I want to thank the chair for having the public hearing that we had over the summer, the informational hearing about this issue, so that the committee could be a real partner with us as the department around our efforts to make improvements in this area. I don't want to repeat the written testimony I gave. I just want to make a couple of points that I think make this issue really critical and that underscore the reason it's a particular priority for us. The medical community, of which I am not a member, and I will just say that up front, is still learning a lot about the impact of these kinds of medications, psychotropic medications, on young children and their bodies. And I think what that means is not just their bodies, also their brains. I think that that really underscores the reason that we need to be hyper-vigilant and diligent about how we use psychotropic medicines and how we have children who are benefiting those. That hyper-diligence also needs to come with expertise. Again, as I mentioned, I am not a member of the medical community, nor are the majority of the people who work for me within the Children, Adults, and Families Division and who perform the service of a caseworker as on the front lines working with these children and their families every day. I think the second dynamic to keep in mind when you think about the requirements this bill would put forward is that because we do not have that expertise, our work in this area really cannot stand alone. We need to be able to fully engage the medical community with us in supporting foster children, and we also need to be certain that the issue of psychotropics does not stand alone, but instead is part of a broader effort that we are trying to make sure that our children who are in foster care get the right services at the right time and that their behavioral health needs are being met and addressed in a very comprehensive way. So for us, as the Representative mentioned, this is not just about psychotropic medications, but it's really about our effort to meet the health needs of kids that we are legally responsible for who are in foster care. The second point I would make is that I really do believe that the children that we're talking about in this bill and that this bill calls out and really lays out a special responsibility around are some of our most vulnerable children in the state, and particularly when it comes to their mental health, to their behavioral health. These are children who have been victims of abuse and neglect, and they have then been had the experience of a second form of trauma, which is often the removal of them from their biological families into the care, hopefully of a relative, but perhaps of someone that they do not know. And that in and of itself, for a child, is a very, very scary thing. Some of the children that we care for, we know, particularly some of our older youth, have very, very significant mental health issues as a result of the trauma they experienced in their own homes. And we have a responsibility when they come into our care to address that. I think that keeping in mind the vulnerability of this particular population is really critical. The other dynamic I would ask you to keep in mind as you think about this issue is that the challenges within foster care of accepting that responsibility are very unique. The legal responsibility for these children lies with the state. These are our children. This is personal. This should be personal to every single one of us in Oregon. The parents, however, of these children still have legal rights, and we need to keep that in mind as we're working with these children and we're working on addressing their needs and the needs of their family holistically so that hopefully they can safely return home. And remember, in 60% of cases, that's actually what happens. The other dynamic that is real for us that makes this complex is that foster parents have the day-to-day contact with these children, and they are, as caregivers on a daily basis, more in tune with what's going on daily with the children than sometimes is the case for our staff, because our staff, as you know, by rule are required to see children every 30 days, but there's a long period of time for a child between 1 and a 30-day period. Those dynamics make this issue of medication oversight and of addressing the mental health needs of kids in foster care incredibly complex. The dynamic around, you know, what we know with respect to medications, our efforts to broadly address the needs of kids, the special responsibility we have for kids in foster care, and the complexity that that responsibility really entails. So I really think it's appropriate that House Bill 3114 really charged the agency, charged the medical community to be able to have a common set of principles around how it is that we provide oversight, particularly around the issue of psychotropic medicines for this special population of kids in foster care. I want to underscore that our commitment really doesn't stop around the recommendations that have come forward with respect to psychotropic medicines and their oversight. We really have been taking steps over the last year to vastly strengthen the work that we do to ensure that we are following through on our legal responsibilities to these kids and really doing the best work that we can for them. We've improved and are in the process of improving our capacity to screen and assess kids so that we can, but that's both in terms of the quality of the screening and assessment and also, as was already mentioned, the quantity. We know that it's often the case that kids are not getting the assessments that they're required to receive in a timely way, and we've set clear goals with ourselves and with the partners in the mental health community around how we can achieve and improve in that area. We want to be able to do that, not just so we have a piece of paper and a number that we can work through, but so we can really evaluate the needs of these children and be meeting those needs, and that may sometimes include a psychotropic medication. We've strengthened our relationship with the medical community, and we've engaged new medical expertise within the department to advise us around particularly complex cases, and some of those do involve psychotropic medications. We now have memorandum of understanding with Dr. Tina Kitchen, who is here, thankfully, with me, to provide us medical expertise, and also with a child psychiatrist, Dr. Nancy Winters, who works with us particularly around behavioral health issues, and we are incredibly grateful for that consultation that we now have, which we didn't before. We've also sought advice from the Drug Use Review Board that advises the Oregon Health Plan more broadly, and the conversation that we've had with them around children in foster care has really grown beyond just children in foster care to all children that the Oregon Health Plan serves and how we address the issue of their utilization of psychotropic medicines, and I think that's a really good thing for all kids who are on the Oregon Health Plan. We're engaging around a second opinion network with the provider community that would be something that all kids in Oregon could hopefully be able to take advantage of, but at least as a priority kids in OHP. We've enhanced medication oversight within CAF. We've even audited our own policy compliance, and the article that you have in front of you shows that we found in that audit, which we imposed upon ourselves, that we have a lot of work to do. And as a result of that, we're going back out into the field now. We know that there are about 1,400 kids who currently have a prescription for a psychotropic medication, and we are going to review every single one of those cases to make sure that it's in compliance with our policy. We take this very, very seriously. I think we have access to better data now than we did before, and I think the work that's happening around the statewide wraparound initiative to ensure that kids' mental health needs are broadly addressed, not just the issue of psychotropics, is really critical. We support House Bill 3114, and Representative Boone, you asked why do this in statute, because we really do believe that this codifies mutual and clear expectations, not just for the Child Welfare Division and for government, but also for the private provider communities that we work with. And we also really strongly support it because it's so consistent with our goal of strengthening oversight in this area. So I will ask for a couple of things. One, that you really listen to and maybe consider the issues that we do need to bring up with a couple of detail in the bill. And also, I just want to get, for the record, maybe a clarification of intent, which I believe is the case, that when children who come into foster care are already receiving and using a psychotropic medication, what I hope the intent of this bill reflects is not that we have to take them off that medication before we can get them an assessment. As I say, we are very, very committed to having them be assessed in a timely way. Currently, our rule requires assessment within 60 days, and we have goals set that a referral would happen within 21. I just want to make sure that we don't disrupt a medication regimen for a child unnecessarily, and I think the way the bill is written now, that does not happen, but I just want to clarify on the record that that's the case. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Kitchen.
Thank you, Erin. Welcome, Dr. Kitchen.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I'm the Medical Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities, and I think I'm here with three hats on, representing Seniors and People with Disabilities, as some technical assistance to children and adults and families, and then Jim Edge was unable to make it today, and so I'm trying to present his testimony. And I'll try to be very, very brief. First off, seniors and people with disabilities also highly supports this bill. Although the statutes that are referenced are the child welfare statutes, we would mimic those standards for a couple of reasons, one of which is we, in developmental disabilities, share the resources, the foster providers, and secondly, we would not want children with developmental disabilities to have a lower standard of oversight than those in child welfare. But let me briefly touch on the few changes that we think would be very helpful. The first one is in Section 1-2A, where it requires a mental health assessment prior to the start of a prescription for a psychotropic medication. Psychotropic medication is a very broad definition that includes stimulants for ADHD, activity disorder, hyperactivity disorder, sleeping medications, and other medications that are normally under the purview of the primary care physician. And we think that it would be better served if we concentrate resources on some of those more complicated conditions and more dangerous medications, to use that word a little bit frivolously, but medications that have very much more significant side effects. And that would be changing the word from psychotropic to antipsychotic medications, because we do believe that those need very careful oversight. The second area that we would suggest some changes is in section, again, 1-2D, and that is the annual assessment. We do not believe that a qualified mental health professional, a QMHP, who does not have prescriptory authority, has the training or the ability to really provide an opinion upon whether or not a medication is appropriate or not, and would suggest deleting that phrase from the bill and leaving it with a licensed medical professional. The second piece on that is Aaron had addressed the fact that we've taken the situation of psychotropic medications in all children with Medicaid to the Drug Utilization Review Board, which is a federally required appointed board of outside professionals to look at this issue. And they recommended a review of children who are receiving more than two, not more than one, psychotropic medication. And since some psychotropic medications are commonly used together, such as a short-acting and a long-acting stimulant drug for ADHD, we would believe that it would be a much better utilization of resources if the more than one would be changed to more than two. So that's it in a nutshell. I understand that you've got some people that you want to testify, but I'd be more than open to questions.
Thank you. And I'm assuming you would come to testify again if we had another hearing. Dr. Kitchen, would that be possible?
Chair Tomei, I can be back at your pleasure.
Great. Thank you.
And maybe even Jim Edge could be here.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I did just want to explain this chart to you briefly. This is our internal tracking mechanism that is based off of a report that Dr. Goldberg commissioned and that was issued last April, I believe, 2008, issuing a series of recommendations to child welfare about how to strengthen our management of medications for children in foster care. And what you'll have here is just how we've acted on those recommendations since the report was released. So we thought it would be helpful for you to have a complete list of all the activity we've undertaken in this respect.
That's great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, one quick question. Dr. Kitchen, on Section 1A, are you suggesting a change to a required assessment by a qualified mental health professional?
In Section 1A, no, that it would be by a qualified medical professional as defined by rule.
No, that's what I'm saying. Could the word say qualified mental health professional?
I mean, mental health professional. Now, we do believe that a mental health assessment is very important, but the change in that section would be psychotropic to antipsychotic. The deletion of mental health professional would come lower in the page on line 26, if I got my glasses on.
Yeah.
That would be a deletion, because the assessment, the annual assessment, would form a different function there, and that would be that this would the appropriateness of the medication, whereas the one above is a more complete assessment of how behavioral approaches are used in the home and whether or not there's therapies being used that other than medications.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I'm assuming we're going to hear from some physicians.
We do have Cliff Johansson here with the Oregon Psychological Association. I don't think we have any of American Medical Association is here, but she's not a physician, I think.
And
so you are a physician. You're
correct,
a
Chair Tomei.
So you have further questions? Well,
and my understanding is that Dr. Willis of the Oregon Pediatric Society submitted written testimony yesterday.
I have Oregon Pediatric Society, and the question is, it's very, their testimony is very contradictory, because they're saying mental health, we have grave concerns about the quality of training required for qualified mental health professionals for psychopharmacological assessment and oversight of children's mental health, which is very contradictory to what the bill is asking to do. So I guess there's apparent conflict between the MD community and the mental health community.
Chair Tomei, I cannot address their testimony. I think that they had concerns about having a mental health specialist have oversight over the prescriptions that they would provide. I'm not convinced that they were concerned about the training of those mental health professionals around ability to assess the behavior supports and the therapy needs of those children.
So maybe it's Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to hope I get this right. This is not to say that we want to take away prescribing authority from the folks who have it, a.k.a. the physicians particularly. But what we're trying to say is, can we have an assessment from a mental health perspective prior to prescribing those drugs? The same person who's doing the assessment is not necessarily doing the prescribing. But the sense that, getting back to the integrated part of this around, we are required to do a mental health assessment when someone enters foster care. Some of the practice happening now is we don't see those children. It takes a long time for them to get the mental health assessment, and the prescribing might be happening very early on, and the assessment happens very late. And we're trying to figure out how do we link these better. And to remind folks, every child who's on foster care is covered by the Oregon Health Plan. There are mental health organizations that are required to provide services. So it's trying to figure out how we make that assessment. It's not saying we don't want to do prescribing, but there has to be an assessment connected with that prescribing. Does that make sense?
It does, but...
We can debate that, but that's the point. Yeah.
But then, in effect, you're taking the prescribing authority away from the licensed provider to do the prescribing because you don't have an assessment. Their testimony is contradictory to the bill, and I'm just going to have to hear from
and
them.
And we'll have further hearing.
That was just the intent. But
I
right. Okay, any other quick questions of this? Representative Boone, do you have any further questions?
Well, I'll ask it. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was trying to help you move on with time, but I'll ask it. I'm just curious, if a child who's put into foster care then is put on the Oregon Health Plan, what if that child is already within their family on another health insurance plan? What happens to that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, if the child already has other health insurance, it's called TPL, third-party liability, and that gets charged first within the department. So if they have other insurance available, we provide wraparound services to the insurance that they have.
Follow-up. So it's connected to it, and the services maybe not provided by the private insurance then would be picked up by the health Oregon Health Plan?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, correct.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative. Okay, we'll be inviting you to come back later at another time. Mark, I know you're signed up, but we're going to have you come back at another time, and Courtney also. But I have Steve McCray, who is a CASA, Terry Fennell, who is a foster parent, and Cliff Johansson from the Oregon Psychological Association. These will be the only people we'll hear from today, unless somebody else has traveled from outside of Salem who would like to speak. Yes, we'll invite you up also. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve McCray. I work with CASA for Children as the program coordinator. Been there for 12 and a half years and been a part of the committee way back starting in 2004 that initially started investigating this the concerns in this area at the behest of the Multnomah County Dependency Court Committee. which I am still a part of. We made some recommendations, which I believe have all been conveyed to folks, and I won't go over those again because of time. But the one concern that I think this bill is meant to address that we raised was the concern about how the decisions are made regarding when a child gets on to psychotropic medication. And what we observed was that the foster parents or care providers were making decisions in conjunction with the physician without any type of consultation or involvement of the agency personnel. And that is not to criticize the foster parents or the physicians. Obviously, they were doing the best things that they thought that they should do. But what ended up happening was that there would be almost two separate planning tracks. There would be the agency creating a treatment plan and trying to address mental health needs, and then there would be this separate function going over here where the treatment provider, where the care provider is talking to the physician, and other things are happening that are not coordinated with the initial plan. And so what ended up happening is the way the law had been written prior was that the foster parent or care provider would provide information after the fact that the psychotropic medication had been started. I think what this bill would do would be to create a discussion, to force a discussion to happen prior to this decision being made, so that the whole range of treatment options would be considered, and so that all the parties would be informed as to what the concerns were, as to what the plan is, and as to what the monitoring and follow-up would be. Because those are the big concerns that the judges had and that the juvenile court community had, that the decisions were being made without full participation and that the monitoring and follow-up was not being done. And this led to some fairly significant issues in some cases. So I want to stress that most of the time, things work out all right, and most of the time these mental health assessments are done on the kids that need them. But there are significant, serious cases where this has not happened, one example being a four-year-old child was prescribed lithium for bipolar disorder, a four-year-old, by a family physician without any discussion or involvement of the caseworker and without a mental health assessment occurring. Since it's already in statute that the mental health assessment is supposed to occur, I think it provides an excellent tool to address the need for this prior discussion and for what Ms. Kelly Seal, I think, very eloquently stated is the important function of making sure that we're looking not only at psychotropic medication as an issue, but at the needs of the whole child and creating a mental health plan that's going to meet those needs. So a couple comments on the bill itself. First off, regarding the suggested change to antipsychotic medication, I can't speak for sure for the committee, but I'm fairly confident that changing that to antipsychotic would be insufficient. I think that would leave out the whole category of antidepressant medications, of medications, mood stabilizing medications for bipolar disorder, and these are concerning medications as well. And even the ADHD medication, I can give one example of a 14-year-old girl who was diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, and she received an ADHD diagnosis, was put on stimulants, and developed psychotic symptoms. And we worked for about 3 years to try to get that decision to be reconsidered, again, after the fact. And it only got resolved when the girl herself, at the age of 17, went to the prescriber and said, I don't want to take this stuff anymore. And she had been diagnosed then with a psychotic disorder and was receiving drug treatment for a psychotic disorder. When she took herself off of everything, the psychotic symptoms disappeared, and she became the person that she was 3 years before that we were trying to point out had been damaged by this intervention. So even something as common as stimulants can have adverse effects, and I think it's appropriate to ask for the mental health assessment. Since we're saying we need to do that anyway, I think it's very appropriate to ask that for whatever medication is being used. The other point regarding the qualified mental health professional, we also talked about this in our committee and agreed that the person who's overseeing the medication, who's reviewing that on an annual basis, a qualified mental health professional is not in a position to do that. So it does need to be somebody with prescribing privileges. And I can't say what the committee would say about one versus two, but it would be consistent with the agency's current policy that they've developed where more than two prescriptions is a red flag criterion. So I don't think that anybody would probably have concerns about that aspect of the bill. The other thing I think that might be important to think about is on number 2A, where it says it requires assessment by a mental health professional. How current would that need to be? Because there are kids who may come into care at the age of 5 and they get a mental health assessment, and when they're, 7 or 8 or 10 years old, that they develop behavioral issues that might require medication. Would it make sense to say that the mental health assessment needs to be within a certain number of months of the decision? I would suggest you might want to think about adding something defining how recent that needs to be. And I think that's all that I have. I do want one more thing, is that I was very impressed with Ms. Kelly Seal's presentation and can't disagree with a word that she said. I'm very happy with the energy that the agency has brought to trying to address this important issue. And thank you all for your work as well.
Thank you, Mr. McCray. I know you were reading from handwritten notes. If you could type up just a few points, that would be great for us to put in our files.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Thank you. So who do we have next?
Chair,
I'm sorry that we're losing people. People had made appointments because the committee was supposed to be through at 10, so I apologize for that. But I wanted to get, especially, I see you all the time, so you can come back and testify another time, too, but if you testify briefly today.
Thank you very much. Representative Tremay, members of the committee, my name is Terry Fennell. I am a foster parent, have been for 23 years. I've served about 700 teenagers, many of whom have been on psychotropic drugs. I support the bill, although I think there does need to be some consideration taken into the fact that to have it come into effect all at once with regard to the medical health professionals seeing all these children prior to and whatever could create a huge challenge with regard to these kids having access to these psychotropics that they need, because of the fact that it's difficult now for us to get an appointment with a licensed professional, a medical health professional, and if all of a sudden every psychotropic would require that, we would have a huge challenge with regard to that. But I think that the intent of the bill, I think, is very on track, and it's very appropriate. My wife actually served on the committee with the agency trying to sort out some of these things, and I think that several of the things that the doctor that spoke first, I'm sorry, I'm spacing her name right now, but
Dr. Kitchen,
several of her points I know that were discussed would be very positive things to consider, and so again, I support the bill, but I do think there may need to be a few changes before it actually would be real effective in terms of creating some challenges, because we would not want these kids to miss the opportunity to have these psychotropics, because their behaviors are oftentimes very, very significantly different when they're on or when they're not on those meds. So thank you very much.
Terry. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Cliff Johansson, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. I'm here today representing the Oregon Psychological Association, and I am conveying that we do support this bill. We do ask for one change, and that has to do with the qualified mental health professional designation. We think that should be changed to licensed mental health provider qualified to diagnose and treat mental disorders in children. And the reason that we want that change is some qualified mental health professionals will be competent to do this job and others will not be. And we think that the licensed professional would help to make that distinction. I think that the rationale for this kind of a mental health evaluation is to consider alternatives to medication that may have fewer harmful effects. However, I think that the mental health evaluation needs to be provided within the scope of practice of the individual professionals. And a non-prescriber, I agree with Dr. Kitchen, that a non-prescriber should not be placed in the position of evaluating the appropriateness of a prescription. And
thank you. And again, if you could put your statement in a one page, that would be terrific, so we put it in our files. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Any quick questions of anyone on this panel? Thank you so much for coming to testify today. We really appreciate it. And I think we have a foster parent, I think, perhaps. Great. Come on up. That's you. Sorry? Did you have a question?
No, Madam Chair, I do.
Okay.
Sorry, do the Republicans have caucus today?
Can you answer that, please?
No. No.
Hi, thanks so much for coming.
Hi.
Give us your name first.
My name's Lisa.
Oh, honey, we need a last name.
Oh, you need a last name. It's Bishop. And I have been a foster parent for 5.5 years. And I've had several children in my home, and I currently only have one. My journey in battle with severe mental illness started approximately 2 years ago. I started to notice that I call my foster son my son. He's been with me 5 years, starting next month. And so we have this relationship. I'm mom, he's my son, and, you know, and so we have that tight bond. So anyways, when I refer to son, it's actually a foster child. So as I started to notice my son started to deal with life a little differently, I recognized that he would have periods of not needing a lot of sleep and would fight with me going to bed at night. Sometimes he would not fall asleep until midnight. He would power struggle about even staying outside even when it was dark. He would get his brain stuck on something and could not stop until he was finished. He would rip parts of the fence in the backyard apart to make boats. One night, he had built a boat that was over 7 feet long, 2 feet high, with a mast towards the front of the boat. I was very tired, so I had been in the house with the door open so I can listen to him. Then it was close to midnight. He came in the house, grabbed a 10-pound bag of potatoes. As he walked back outside, I asked him what he was doing with the potatoes. He told me that he had filled the boat up with all my potting soil, and he needed to bury the potatoes so they would grow bigger. Another night, when he refused to come in the house, he had taken a bunch of boards down the street and around the corner to a friend's house. He positioned himself under a street light. He had to build a boat, which was small. He had to have it completed before his birth dad would arrive. He finally got too tired and came right in before midnight. He also would sneak out of the house at all hours of the night and be gone for up to 7 or 8 hours, sometimes more. One of his nightly adventures landed him clear down here in Salem. His story was that his birth dad kidnapped him by breaking into our house, forcing him to drive around all night with a bag over his head. When he was able to get out of the car, he was right in front of his birth mom's home, and she chased him down the road yelling for him to come back. During that situation, he did not know that his birth dad was in the Oregon State Penitentiary, and his birth mom had passed away 2 years earlier. At the other end of things, my son would get so sad and depressed that he would attempt suicide several times, including just 16 days ago.
How old is he, Lisa?
He's now 16.
Thank you.
While all this was going on, I spoke to the caseworker about 2 years ago that I thought he was possibly starting to develop bipolar along with some other type of psychosis. I was told by her that no, he wasn't. Then I spoke with the psychiatric medication management doctor, and they gave me the same answer. So I struggled with my son for quite a while. Still not being heard or listened to, I was able to get my son out of the county mental health facility just last year. He had completely hit rock bottom. In a 4-month period of time, he was hospitalized over 50 nights. Then the county mental health facility that I thought I was rid of, because I'd actually gotten him into another program at Albertina Kerr. Awesome. And then the county mental health facility that I thought I was rid of showed up at the meeting about how to best help my son. One lady from the county mental health facility said that she has known my son for 2 years on paper and thought he should go to the state mental hospital. After 4 years of my son living with me, I called his DHS attorney and told him what was going on. That attorney helped with keeping my son in my home. There were two psychiatric doctors that finally saw exactly what I was been trying to explain for over a year and a half. One doctor started the process of stabilizing him on meds, and the other one finished up the process. I will be forever grateful to those two doctors for really listening and understanding. Currently, my son is now at a local high school and doing very well.
I agree that psychotropic medications should be dispensed only when truly needed, but this was a child that was in desperate need of something, and they let him suffer for quite a while. Many things he does not remember during that time. Other times he remembers things, and then he feels guilty over the things he did. I also feel that having a second doctor look at a patient that has psychiatric issues is a good thing. Many times others that are not familiar with certain situations may think of something that the regular person may not think of. Doctors also need to listen to the people that live with the patients every day. The ones living with the patients every single day are the ones that need to be heard. The ones that live with the patients are the experts.
Thank you, Lisa. Any quick questions?
So,
thanks for all the work that you do, Lisa. That's a hard job.
Oh, my gosh. Last year, for about 8 months in time, I slept on the couch for 8 months, and I averaged about 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night because I wasn't being heard or listened to at all. Including having a doctor prescribe medication that the child wasn't even taking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm assuming there are no other foster parents here wishing to speak. Thank you all for staying. For those that we weren't able to hear, we will have another hearing, and we will listen to whomever has testimony on this bill. With that, I will close the hearing, 3114, and close the House Committee on Human Services.
No, thank you all.